Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon, Tennis World. Thursday, June 13th, 2013. This is the Bruce Lipka Show. Join me today, Blog Talk Radio on the UR Tennis Network. This is Bruce Lipka coming to you live from our nation's capital. First of all, today, a happy birthday to my father, the man responsible for me being involved in tennis. Many times as I wanted to move away from it, Dad kept me coming back for more, and I'll forever thank him for that, because what a wonderful life it's been being a tennis player. Folks, we got a real interesting show today. We have on our show today, we're going to have a special guest who's coming to us from across the Atlantic Ocean from the UK, Bruce Tarrin. We're doing something completely different today, and Bruce is Skyping in, and I think I've got him on the line with me now. Bruce, are you there?
I'm here, Bruce. Hi. Can
okay.
You hear me?
Yep, we can hear you. The folks can all hear you. We have had a rash of thunderstorms in my area, so if at any point in time today, folks, I disappear, just stay with me while I dial back in. The power's been kicking on and off a little bit here, but hopefully we'll get a good hour of time here. We're going to jump real quick to a commercial, and when we come back, we're going to be live with Bruce, and we're going to talk about all things tennis, not just U.S., not just U.K., but globally. So, folks, stay with us real quick. We're going to break for a quick commercial.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
All right, folks, welcome back to the show. Bruce, thanks so much for joining us today on the show. How are things over there, getting ready for Wimbledon to start? Queens is underway. It's your guys' tournament season. What's happening over there in terms of tennis?
Well, just where I'm at the moment, Bruce, it's just the same as you. We're having thunderstorms and it's raining on us. But overall, of course, we've got Queens going on. I don't know, do you get to watch that at all in where you are?
We do. We've got, you know, in the last couple of years, we've got the Tennis Channel, which, you know, carries, if you get up early in the morning, we had the Gary Weber coming on from Germany, and we got Queens comes on after that, and next week we'll have a couple of tournaments, and without the Tennis Channel, we didn't used to have much tennis, but now, thank goodness, we get lots.
Well, we get to see a bit on Eurosport and on cable, but the thing is now in Britain, we're gearing up for Wimbledon. It's one of the bad things in Britain, really, that tennis seems to be too much around Wimbledon, and everything's around Wimbledon, and you get wall-to-wall coverage. We'll have, from the first ball hit, you'll be able to watch every single court in play through the 2 weeks of Wimbledon, and then Wimbledon will finish, and it falls away a bit. So we're sort of too focused on Wimbledon a bit, but you can watch every ball that's hit. And while Wimbledon's on, there wouldn't be a park in the country where people aren't playing tennis. You know, it's a really great thing, but it's probably not year-round enough with us. It's great. Wimbledon's a great time. We get to see a lot of tennis, and all the tennis stars come to Britain, and it's the centre of the tennis universe for a bit. So we just have to try and make the most of it, really.
Well, it's interesting because, if we go back in time, you know, when we look at the powers that were tennis some time ago, and there was Australia, there was French, there was U.S., and there was the U.K., and the reason is that the reason the Grand Slam tournaments became known as the Grand Slam is because those were the championships of each of the countries that had won the Davis Cup at that point in time. So those countries' championships made up what now we call the Grand Slam. And it seems like, you know, in the modern game right now, I think the French seem to be doing the best and seem to have the most players succeeding at a high level and seem to have a very developed tournament system. The U.S., you know, seems to come behind. We're a big country with a lot of commercial interests, it seems like, in tennis at times. And then there's Australia and the U.K. What do you think, why are the French have come up with this great tournament system and they've got what they've got versus we don't have anything like it in the U.S.? We're struggling to get kids to participate in tennis. You know, I don't know what you've got going over there. You know, you've maybe got weather, some other challenges. Australia certainly has good weather. They've struggled to bring along tennis players. What do you think the French do that make it so easy for them to produce so many players?
Before I say about that, I'd just say it's a bit of a myth that Britain has done well in tennis really for a while. We've had individual players like Henman and Murray. We've had a few ladies who've done well. Virginia Wade won Wimbledon and Ann Jones. But at the moment in America, you've got you've got eight or nine players in the world top 100. We've got Murray. But after Murray, can you guess what our number two ranked player is?
I'm going to go with 317.
Well, that's good man. No, it's 215. But that's not,
okay. I was off by 100.
Right.
Not bad guess.
No, it's only 100 off, but the wrong way. But so we're struggling and have been for a long time. Why are France doing so well? Well, they put a very good They put a good structure in place a while ago, didn't they? They've got the rating system. We based our rating system on there, where they have a rating system where all players get a rating and move up and down, which is a nice thing. But then we based ours on that, and we haven't done so well. They've got a very nice structure, but then we've got a very nice structure, and we haven't done so well. Why have the French done so well? It's a tough one, isn't it? But they have invested. They've got a good structure. Of course, they've got a good climate. People here would say that clay is quite important. In Spain and in France, they have the clay courts, which obviously when you're teaching kids, it allows more time. It allows them to have more time to prepare. They're going to hit more topspin. They're going to hit a better shot. And historically, we've had grass, and now we've got synthetic grass on too many courts, which doesn't give the kids a lot of time to prepare. But we are getting now artificial. We've just at my club, we've now got four artificial clay, and they're playing pretty nice, and they're not big on upkeep. And I think that could be quite a good thing for us. But yeah,
now why at the club did they choose the artificial clay instead of, you know, real clay?
In Britain we can't have artificial clay because the weather is rubbish, and you could only use it maybe 7 months, 8 months, and also it's the cost of upkeep. I mean, even in Europe now, where staff are becoming more expensive, it gets harder to keep up the clay. This is where Eastern Europe has an advantage now. And you probably know, but at the last Wimbledon, there were 32 seeds in the ladies, and 16 of them came from Eastern Europe. So although you're saying France is doing well, Eastern Europe's not doing too bad. And they've got not much money, but they are doing pretty good.
Well, certainly in a sport like ours, where it's really one-to-one combat. It's one person versus another person. It takes a great deal of discipline. It takes a great deal of competitiveness. It's not really a sport for the faint of heart, per se. You've really got to want to do well, and certainly if you come from more meager beginnings, you might be more motivated to pull yourself up in the world. Maybe there's a lot of the motivation. But why, when you guys started, when Roger Draper took over the LTA and they pumped tons of money into it, you know, money was there, they built some facilities, you know, where's the missing piece? Why hasn't there been an ignition of play on the junior levels that lead to, of course, higher world-class players?
Okay, well, I was at the LTA just recently and we're talking and we were saying about all the kids doing so well in Eastern Europe. And someone said, he said, well, of course, they're doing well despite the fact that they haven't got the LTA, they haven't got the organization. And that is such a classic. People say, well, Eastern Europe do well despite the fact that they haven't got lots of money being spent. They haven't got a lot of structure. They haven't got a lot of prescription. And I thought about that. And in a sense, well, maybe, and I said, maybe it's not they're doing well despite that. They're doing because of that. And then the other, so they're doing because there's no prescription. They're doing well because there's no, they said that the reason Eastern Europe do well is because they haven't got health and safety the same. So they don't have to be prescriptive. But then maybe that's because. And then the other side of that is, well, British players are doing badly despite all the money and the LTA and prescription and all the rest. And then you turn it on the head and there is the argument that maybe it's not despite, it's because.
I think I like that argument, and I'll tell you why. I think the reason that if you give too much to a tennis player, you know, a tennis player really has to be the ultimate form of someone who earns things. Because every time you play tennis, you earn. You always have to earn. You earn every point. You earn every match. To put a tournament together, to say you won a tournament, you have to put a multiple number of matches together over consecutive days. Everything is earned. You know, you want to be a pro tennis player, there's no salary. You don't get paid to just play like a basketball guy or a soccer guy or a football guy. You know, you have to, every week, you know, as they say, you eat what you kill. You know, so if you take that edge off of the tennis player, to me the most important thing we could develop in the tennis players at a young age is that ability to earn everything they want to have. The worst thing we can do is give free passes and wild cards and unearned anything. I mean, it just seems like it's a really bad system. I know we do it in the U.S., but answer this for me. In the U.S., one of the reasons I think tennis struggles, I think there are two reasons. Number one, we have a society now where the kids are they're very arrogant. There's a high level of arrogance among our children in the U.S. and entitlement, but a very low level of self-esteem. You know, we give our kids trophies, you know, for participating in things. You know, we inflate the grades in school so they all think they're doing better than they do. You know, it's all this sort of thing, and it's not real. You know, that's one part of it. And the other part of it is the tennis coach in the U.S. is more a businessman now than a developer of the discipline of tennis. Whereas they used to be, guys love tennis. Now everyone opens an academy. Everyone wants to make money. It's a business. How many kids can we get on the court? Happy, busy, hitting balls. So those two things to me in America have sort of caused the downfall of us creating the really high-level competitive player who needs the edge. You know, if it's a family deal like Wayne Bryan with his boys, you know, I think it's Andy Roddick's nephew now is a new young up-and-coming player. Very young, but the grandparents involved, and they're doing it right, and the kid's got the edge. You know, that seems to be what we struggle from in the U.S. What's going on in the British society? Are the kids as entitled and as spoiled as here, or is it a little different?
Well, both of those points are good. So certainly the first point I would have agreed with maybe up until a few years ago, and certainly until the Olympics. Because I wonder if sometimes, I mean, of course our kids are entitled, our kids are a bit spoiled, our kids have a lot. But we just had the Olympics here, and we finished Britain for not a big country. We finished third, and we were winning in cycling. We were winning in rowing. We had a lot of gold medals. And these are the same kids who tennis coaches have been saying, well, they aren't prepared to work hard. They aren't prepared to commit. So I have always felt, you know, you're right. You teach kids now, they are a bit spoiled. They won't pick up the balls. They're giving you a hard time, and you're right. But on the other hand, I think your kids and our kids have something deep down which shows in other sports. And so we did very well at the Olympics, so maybe why aren't our kids doing well in tennis? They're the same kids. For the second point with the coaches, I think I agree. I think but you're always going to get obsessive, crazy coaches, maybe like us. And particularly at the start of your career, you're crazy, you're obsessive, you want your kids to do well. You phone on the phone all the time to the parents, and it's nonstop. And it's, you know, you wake up in your night, you think, well, that's what I could do. So you're very obsessive. And I think those coaches would always be there. I think they need more encouragement because they're often individual kind of coaches, often fighting with the establishment a bit, and they're often not allowed to free rein quite enough.
It seems like that's the whole challenge that we have here. Would seem that I know that, you know, you're just a little bit older than me. We don't have to tell our listeners how old we are, but we've been around for a while. And you play. I like to play. You like to play. I just come back from playing a little event in Barcelona. You're playing, you know, events, ITF. We play. We coach. We love tennis. And as the years go by, we seem to continue to get a deeper and better understanding of ourselves, of our students, of how to coach, of how to communicate, you know, all these things. And the passion, though, doesn't seem to lessen. The patience sometimes grows with the student, but the patience for the politics might lessen and not have patience for the nonsense. But are you guys over there hiring guys in our age, our experience levels, or do you do there just what they do here and, you know, take the players who are ranked high on the tour who are 30 years old and put them in charge of coaching the kids?
Well, I mean, I respect the people who've been playing and who then go into coaching. They're really good guys, and they obviously had a huge passion for the game when they were playing. Like, you could argue that people are playing, sometimes they don't quite make it as players, and they probably are a bit fed up with tennis, and they look around and they say, well, what can I do? I can be a tennis coach. And because they've got a low world ranking or a British ranking, then it's possible, they go into coaching, and they're probably they're working where they don't have the passion, maybe because they've had a tough time on the tour and maybe not quite made it. But I do have huge respect for those guys because they're nice players. But it is maybe a slight problem. The other thing Britain has done is hire a lot of foreign coaches, of course, trying to buy success in that way. But I don't want to criticize coaches or tennis players because, you know, for me, they've all got a lot to offer. But I do agree. Yeah, we do the same thing. We take people off the tour, make them coaches, put them in charge of kids, our best kids, and it is arguable that sometimes they don't have, they're a bit fed up with tennis. You know, you get burned out. I'm not saying they are, but it is possible to play. You play on the tour, you want to be a Wimbledon player, you get to number 400 in the world, which is wonderful, and then you get a job, and you're slightly fed up with tennis, but you look around and what can you do? So you coach tennis, and that is obviously a problem.
Well, you talk about the international coaches. You know, here in the U.S., of course, we've got Jose Higueras, an international guy, who is in charge of our coaching, our development program, and it's interesting because, you know, in the U.S. in the 70s, we had the tennis boom, and some of the guys who were coaching in the tennis boom are no longer really coaching. Mr. Hopman's passed away, and Dennis Vandermeer's, so a lot of these guys are not there, but the generation of guys who played and some of the generations of guys who coached are in their 70s now, and they're still around, and they're very good, and they've mentored many fine players, yet we're not reaching out to any of those guys to get them involved. Do they reach out to the guys, I'll call them, for lack of a better word, Bruce, are they reaching out to the right people to get them involved, or What's the motivation there?
Well, it's very easy for a national association which isn't succeeding to be a little bit defensive. And so when coaches outside are succeeding in small ways or being a little bit critical, it's very hard for the national association to embrace them, because in Britain, the RTA hasn't succeeded, it would be fair to say, for quite a while. And so they do become quite defensive, which is understandable. So they're not probably going to reach out and embrace outside the structure very easily. You could argue that. Yes.
Is the top sport for your kids? So our kids growing up here, they watch TV is inundated with every sport but tennis, of course, in the U.S. And it's not a big soccer is not a big thing on TV either. However, soccer for us here is probably the number one youth sport. Kids start at such a young age, and we've got the British Soccer Academy, and we've got the Brazilian Soccer Academy.
Okay.
So soccer becomes big for kids, but what's the order of the sports over there that the kids, really sort of go to?
Well, soccer would be number one, and probably number two and number three, and it might be number four as well. So soccer's big, but soccer's a world sport. Soccer's big. But as I say, in the Olympics, Britain did well. And I don't want to say it again, but we did well. We finished third, I think, on the medals table. And we showed that we're a good sporting nation, like Australia. You said Australia, great. America, a great sporting nation. The United States, a great sporting nation. And I think, in a sense, we'll all have our day. But our big sports will be soccer. Tennis probably comes down about number five, but when Wimbledon's on, we're number one. So you get seasons in Britain. When the test matches are on, cricket's quite big. You wouldn't know about cricket, but we play that as well. And then rugby is quite a big game here when the rugby matches are on. When I was a kid, whatever sport was on TV, we would play. So me and my brothers would go out and we'd play a bit of cricket if cricket was on the TV, a bit of soccer if soccer was on, a bit of tennis. We'd be playing table tennis if that was on the TV. I think that was great, we'd be doing horse racing if we could, if that was on the TV. So soccer's the big one. And of course we're fighting against that. But you can still get athletes into your sport, can't you? I mean, that's up to us. We've got to get out there and get the athletes and inspire them.
Is it expensive for the kids to play tennis? We all hear I don't know what your weather's really like. I've never lived there, but we hear the rumors, of course, and the weather's so bad. Is there ample and affordable indoor court time, or is that not really necessary?
Indoor courts are expensive, and there's not enough. But again, people can succeed without it, and we tend to play in the rain, and we were coaching in the snow. We were coaching in the snow. I've coached sliding about. You don't do it so much now. But you can play in anything, and that's what we encourage. And as for expense, it is more expensive than soccer. That's what's so good about soccer, I think. It's very cheap, and you can put stuff on. But probably it's the same with you. It is too expensive, in a sense.
We of course have a very large country, and some parts of the country the temperature is extremely temperate. And even here where I live in Washington, D.C., which we consider, the southern part of the Northeast, but, we're in the Northeast U.S., the Mid-Atlantic area. Do we need indoor courts here? Yes, we do, but like this winter was mild enough that if you didn't have indoor courts, you could have played outside all but, I don't know, maybe 20 days this winter, when the temperature was bad or there was too much rain or something like this. So we have a different set of circumstances. Yes, indoors is a little expensive. Have the kids play tournaments, it gets a little expensive and inconvenient. The matches are late in the evening on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, whenever they might be. So it's always seemed to me like instead of the USTA doing things the way they did it, if I had a magic wand, what I would do is I would build facilities. I would have the USTA, instead of paying coaches to coach kids part-time, I would have guys run facilities, and I would supplement their pay so they could work with kids for free, court time for kids could be for free. And almost like, I don't know if you're familiar with, I don't know if they do it in soccer, but here in the U.S. in basketball, one of the things you do is you go to a park and you want to play. So some guys are playing and somebody calls next. Means they have the next game. That game ends. The next guy grabs four guys. Now they go out and play a game. And the winner keeps the court. And the losers have to get off the court. And it creates very competitive players. This goes on all day and all night under the lights. You play in almost any weather, depending where you live. New York City, Chicago. Some of these cities have some of the greatest playground games of all time. And I felt like, what a great model if we could just offer, here's balls, here's rackets, here's courts. Who wants to play tennis? You know, that might be a good use of the money. Am I dreaming, or do you think there's any merit to that?
No, it's great. I mean, it's great. Maybe I should be playing basketball. But and also, with your weather, gosh, you're a lucky guy, aren't you? Are there any jobs there? Because it just sounds good. But with the building facilities, yes. But I've always believed that facilities don't produce players. People do. So if you've got a county or a region for you, the same coach is usually producing the players. So, yeah, you want to put the facilities in place, and then you want to give it to the right coaches who've got a track record of showing that they care. And then, yeah, it'll go well.
But don't you feel as if you look at yourself in the mirror, don't you feel like if someone handed you six indoor courts and six outdoor courts and said, Bruce, here you go, it's yours.
Yeah.
Do whatever
you
want with it. We're going to cover the expense. We're going to give you some rackets for the kids, some balls.
Yeah.
You know, just make the magic happen. Don't you think you would drive around the countryside, find kids, hey, come with me, give it a try. I mean, don't you feel like you could get it going, make something good happen?
You wouldn't need to go anywhere. You get them from the schools within walking distance because any kids would want to play sport, you know. There's every school's got a kid who could make it to Wimbledon, I honestly believe. You know, so many kids have got potential. Often it's mental potential, just wanting it. And, of course, instead of which the money goes into 5-year plans and, you know, office jobs and all that. And, my gosh, give facilities to the coaches who produce players, let them get on with it, instead of putting all the money into, like, a big bureaucracy, because obviously the centre becomes a little bit bureaucratic. And with the best will in the world, they're doing the best by their lights. But are they really the best people to produce players? Whereas in Eastern Europe, where you don't have that kind of centralization, where you've got everyone out there desperately doing all they can. I teach a lot. I'm a lot in Eastern Europe. And you see the coaches there, all different kinds of guys, all pulling their weight and on the mobile phones a lot, but having a good time. And the kids having to work hard, the parents outside doing the stretching with the kids, making them run up and down the steps, you know. It's madness, but it's lots of different people doing their thing rather than a central authority, not smothering, but you know what bureaucracy can do.
Sure.
And,
one of our big bureaucratic nightmares that we've had in the U.S. And I'm not sure where I weigh in on it. I'll weigh in a minute. But one of our big bureaucratic nightmares has been over the red, orange, green balls. But before we dive into that and the politics of it, let's take a break real quick for about 60 seconds. We got a commercial. This is Bruce Lipka today on The Bruce Lipka Show. My guest, Bruce Tarrant, coming over from the U.K. with us today, telling us a little about what's happening over there. Our call-in number, 714-583-6853. If anyone has any questions, I've got a couple email questions, Bruce, that we'll get to in a little while that a few folks have sent in. But we're going to break for a quick commercial now, about 60 seconds, and we'll be right back. Stay with us, folks.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for staying with us here. You know, Bruce, where we left off was we were talking a little about the bureaucracy, and we spent an absolute fortune in this country from the USTA on the red, orange, green ball program. And where I'm going with this is, related to what you said before, as opposed to, you know, just saying, hey, here are learning tools available, and let the good coach figure out, because I don't know about you, but I've always used some semblance of deader balls with younger kids that bounce lower and they can keep in play, or beginning adults, whoever they might be. But here they mandated that kids 10 and under had to play with these green dot balls. And I'm sure there are many good examples. I've used them myself and they're positive. But, you know, for a kid who wants to be a world-class player, to me the analogy that I heard that works best is, it's like saying, you know, the average kid doesn't walk until 2. So if your kid stands up at 16 months, we're going to knock them back down and make them crawl, you know, for another period of time, for 8 more months until we let them walk, because you got to crawl until you're 24 months old. That's just the way it is. So we've taken these kids, we're forcing them to play the green dot ball. Some kids, like the Roddick boy, has outgrown it. He had to play age group up tournaments, so he went older because you're not allowed to play, you know, with the regular ball. And now that he's old enough to play with the regular ball, he's dominating, and you can see where his growth is behind a little bit. Have you guys had any mandates like that of the color balls in your countries, or is it just use what you use?
Well, we've got the red, the orange, and the green. But at least with the green, you're on the whole court. We've got under 8s are red, under 9s are orange, under 10s are green. Do you have that as well? Where?
No, we only have, for tournament play, 10 and under tournaments, and they use the green dot. The other green age groups, we use them to teach with, but there are no mandated tournaments.
Well, in some cases, maybe you should thank your lucky stars, because we have under 8s have to play with red balls on a small court, under 9s have to play with orange balls on a cut-down court, under 10s have to play with green balls on a full court. If you're under 8, you can't play against under 9s. If you're under 9s, you can't play against under 10s. And if you're under 10, you can't play against under 12s. Each group has to be separate. The red balls, for me, are a wonderful teaching tool. All low compression balls are very useful in teaching, particularly when you've got 5-year-olds, and also indoors it's very good using a sponge. So you've got 5-year-olds who aren't very gifted. Well, no, that's not fair. 5-year-olds haven't played much. They're small. They have the red ball. They can rally. They can play. As we speak down my tennis club, we've got little kids playing now, maybe 30 or 40 we had in the reds, and they would have been playing. And they're great. So low compression balls are great teaching tools. The cut-down courts are great. I do think that the prescription around them in England, where under 8s can't play with under 9s, under 9s can't play with under 10s, probably hasn't been hugely positive.
Whose idea was this? Was this a group of people got together? Was this the head of development?
Because I think it's probably from I think the ITF a little bit. It seemed to start in Britain a little, but I'm not absolutely sure, Bruce. But I don't want to name names. There's a couple of guys who have now left. I think they're working for a foreign football federation who were quite involved. But, you know, everyone's doing their best. Everyone's having what they consider good ideas. But I don't think this is a great one. But it's absolutely the basis of tennis in Britain now. You know, under 8s, under 9s, under 10s, all playing with different balls on different size courts.
We almost had to build a new storage room here to just house all the balls and all the mini nets. But it just seems like, what happened to the good old-fashioned ingenuity of the passionate coach? So give them some tools. Great. Mm-hmm. You know, my coach used to push the net down and make it just a little bit lower. You know, we use a half a court, you know, at a time. If we got four kids on the court, to learn how to play the net, can't cover. I mean, deader balls, whatever you might do. Where's the ingenuity of the coach, and what kind of coaches do we have, or will we have? What kind of people stay in a system where their ingenuity and their enthusiasm and their creativity are shut down for, you know, and instead they're forced fed certain programming. It seems like we might lose the best and the brightest.
Oh, I don't know. Young people come into it and they tend to accept, don't they? So maybe the younger people, the older people. Well, I use them. As I say, we've got red courts. We've got the little kids. We've got the red balls using them. It works well. We're using the orange. It works. It isn't so much the balls, because if you're a proper coach, you can use them to an extent how you want. I mean, there's no one from the LTA standing as saying, no, you've got it. So we do use orange. I mean, I use orange balls with the better kids, the reds. I use green sometimes with the even with the orange. You know, I mean, I use better balls with kids. I move them on in coaching. The trouble is, it's a prescription in competition. So you got a kid of we got a kid of six who's I had an 8 year old when I was coaching. We had a 400 stroke rally. You know, a girl, her sister was national champion. She was 8 years old. We had a 400 stroke from the back. Now she'd have to play in a match. She'd have to play sponge balls on a court the size of two service boxes.
And that's something that someone at that talent level outgrows.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of teaching, surely, is that you move kids on, don't you? You're a teacher,
yeah.
So if you're a teacher as a kid, you want to stretch them. If you stretch a child, they grow.
Right.
And that's basic, isn't it? I mean, that is basic. But of course, they could say, maybe that's what they were trying to get at the LTA when they're saying about health and safety holding back. They're trying to say, well, you know, you can't have 8-year-olds hitting yellow balls. They hurt their arm. But then let them hit orange balls, you know, or even green. But,
green balls.
Kids who are improving can be stretched without endangering their safety, I think.
Sure. I think that's the only way that, you know, take any student in school, the first time a teacher in math introduces multiplication, you know, the kids look at it and you got to break it down and they don't know what they're talking. By the end of the year, the kids can multiply, you know, four numbers by four numbers. But it's you stretch them and they grow into it.
If you think about it, that's what education is all the way through. And that's what good teachers do. They push kids, especially the gifted kids. Of course, you can't exclude the less gifted. You can't exclude the social kids who just want to be playing. And that's what those balls are for. But not to stretch talented kids is almost criminal.
Well, we lost a whole generation of players in the U.S. back in the 90s when it was thought that the solution to our declining excellent player population would be to cancel the 12 and unders because players were getting burnt out. And all that happened was our most competitive kids who love to compete, they just went to other sports, you know, because they're 12 years old. They want to play, you know, to the nationals, to the sectional. They wanted to play big tournaments. They wanted to have competition. They wanted to use the best of the best. You know, instead they went to play soccer or baseball where they could play on travel teams and go play against the best. So that didn't work out too well. I fear that this bottling up of players, this bottleneck of keeping people down, may unfortunately cause the same problem with us here, but I hope I'm wrong.
Well, you haven't got it as bad, have you? Because at least it's only – I mean, I know it's but at least it's only competitively at under 10 of a green ball. So for you, an 8-year-old can still play on a whole court if they're good enough.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is here, we really don't have tournaments per se for anything
under
younger 10. Than 10 and under. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have the Little Mo Nationals, and the Little Mo Nationals do use regular balls on a whole court, and they do have younger age divisions. But there are no, you know, here in the Mid-Atlantic area of the USTA section, which we are, you know, Virginia, Maryland, and D.C., we're not one of the bigger sections, but we're probably one of the smaller. We're a regular-sized section. You know, we have 10 and under tournaments, 12 and under, but we don't have any 8 and under tournaments. We have, or 9 and under. 10 and under is the youngest tournaments.
Well, you have bigger, probably bigger traveling distances as well. But we're great in some ways. We have under 10, we have under 9, we have under 8. We have a good tournament structure. The trouble is that the under 8s can't play with the under 9s, you can't play with the under 10s. So the tournaments are so small because they limit the ages that not in the big urban conurbations, if you're in the big cities, but in especially the girls. The girls have been really affected. I mean, we used to have good under 10 girls club competitions. There isn't one now. And,
really?
No, it's gone. And even the under 12s, I did a thing where there's something like 13 of our counties don't have a girls under 12 league anymore for clubs. I had an under 12 girl who she was the only entrant in her county closed competition, which is pretty scary. So it's the girls have been quite badly affected because they're under 8 and under 9. Girls don't really want to be playing with boys, and they're slightly stuck playing with boys because of the lack of numbers, because under 8s can't play with under 9s, under 10, under 9s can't play with under 10s. I think it is, in a sense, you're better off having...
Well, within the society structure, our kids over here, I've always felt like in order to accomplish anything... As a young person, you have to dream a little bit. You want to be a doctor? Great. You're watching doctor shows on TV. You're dreaming of someday doing surgery. You want to be a lawyer? You're watching lawyer shows. You're dreaming of someday arguing in front of the judge and making your point. Whatever it might be, you want to be a teacher someday? You're dreaming of being a teacher. I got my daughter lines the dolls up in her room. She gets up with a whiteboard, and she's teaching doll school. She wants to be a teacher one day. She's doing it. And those are all perfectly acceptable vocations to pursue here in the United States. It seems like, though, a lot of the kids are discouraged from pursuing a vocation as a professional tennis player, not skipping their education. You know, get your education, take care of it, but it's frowned upon, and they say, oh, you know, so few people make it, it's really not something to shoot for. And I've always felt like it's the side lessons you learn in trying to reach your potential as a player that are valuable. I mean, what's the education career track? So here in the U.S., kids go to high school. They're encouraged to go to college. Most do. Most go not to vocational technical school. Most go to a college or a junior college, then a college, then get a job. That's how they do it in the U.S. Are you the same over there, the high school, college? I mean, what do you think the attendance rates are like to go from high school to college? And is it okay for a kid to dream of being a pro athlete, or are they discouraged?
Well, first of all, I agree with you so much. I think getting to be good at tennis is worth so much. You know, being most people aren't good at anything. To be really good at something is something which sticks with you for your whole life. And, you know, I mean, you're good at tennis, and that's been a great thing in your life. It gives you confidence. It's superb. For a kid, they want to be as best they can be. They want to do as good as they can be. So you don't want to be saying, you won't be able to make it. You just say, be as good as you can be. And if they make it, great. But even talking about making it is, for me, the wrong thing. I just want to be as good as they can be in everything they attempt. And that's great. Impressing upon parents how great it is for their kids to play tennis and how much they get out of it. You can go to any country in the world, any big city, and if you're good at tennis, you can find a local tennis club, and you'll immediately have a circle of friends, and that's just great, isn't it? And there's nothing better.
Yep.
In Britain, what do we do? Well, you guys are lucky, really, because you've got the university system. I've had quite a few players who have, of course, gone to America. Some like it, some don't, and played it in the college system with you. We don't really have that. We have very few with, you know, some LTA sponsors, unis, and there is a bit. But not as good as you guys. So
we were very jealous. Well, would it be like Tennis Australia right now has two full-time staff members helping their junior players who aren't ready to turn pro find opportunities at the universities in the U.S. because there's lots of opportunity. Is that something that the LTA embraces or do they frown upon?
Well, I think there's a lot of players go to America, you know, at 18 or 19. Whether or not that really is difficult, isn't it? Again, they're probably using it a little bit as an experience. They're hoping maybe more than believing that they're going to make it if they're going to America. Because probably if they're 19, they'd probably be going and playing tournaments, wouldn't they, for a year or two? But if they are coming to them, the LTA they wouldn't frown on it. Because it's a great thing. You have people over here, agents, don't you? Agents approaching people Some of the universities used to send people over, didn't they, to scout.
Yeah, to recruit Junior Wimbledon, yep.
Yeah, so, no, I mean, I've got a player now who's considering it. So, I wouldn't think the Altai are involved one way or the other. They're not going to stop people, I don't think. You know,
well, do you have, in the U.S., we still have amateur sport because of the college system and the sports and all the sports in the college system. You have to be an amateur, basketball, football, hockey, you know, tennis. And there's some often debate with the tennis players, particularly the international ones, the French ones, the German ones, the Spaniards. They might play for a club somewhere. They might have played some futures. They might play money tournaments. They might not really be, quote, amateurs. Is tennis still, under 18 tennis, purely an amateur sport in the U.K.?
I don't think there's any, I think about 30 years ago I got money for, I don't think there's anything like that really, but I know there is that amateur thing because of your colleges, but I don't think in this country there's anything like that, no.
I don't think it exists anywhere else on the globe anymore ever since the Olympics went pro.
We
I think we're the only country that still has amateur sport.
Yes. Well, good luck to you. I mean, yes, but I think no. We just want the money. But
is there prize money in junior tournaments?
Yeah, a little bit. But to my mind, if someone's really good at sport, they've worked blooming hard for it, haven't they? And often, the amount of time you spent practicing and playing tennis would be as much as many people are studying for their degree or whatever. So maybe you deserve to get something back for it, if it's there.
I do think you deserve it, whether, you know, they need to adjust the rules or something. But I just feel like it's an odd table to compare the different countries with, particularly, you know, because we've had such an influx of the international player into the U.S. collegiate system in many sports, but tennis, really, there's been a great influx. A lot of the sports, though, have had, you know, some years ago, Iowa State University, which is in the middle of the United States, which there was no history of fantastic, you know, long-distance runners, all of a sudden start becoming fantastic because the coach started recruiting, you know, the fourth-tier kids from Kenya who weren't even good enough for the national squad, but those guys are way better than what we've got over here.
Yes. That's really good, is it? No,
I mean, but that's, you know, and there's some talk here about, you know, the same way that if you go play for a German club, you know, they're only allowed one or two non-German nationals to play on the team. There's been some talk here about limiting the number of non-U.S. players, but, you know, then there's some legal things. It just seems like the system's a little bit messy right now, and I've always felt like, you know, the line in the sand, if we're going to be amateurs, let's be amateurs. If not, then let's change it. Yeah. But I don't know. Let me ask you a little about the professional organizations over there. You know, for our teaching pros here, really, almost anybody can pick up a basket of balls, go to a park, call himself a pro, and start teaching lessons. You know, we've got the PTR, the Professional Tennis Registry. We've got the USPTA, the United States Professional Tennis Association. We've got the USTA has some certifications. But, you know, they're not consolidated. They're always battling with each other. Folks slip through the cracks. What does the professional standard look like by you guys?
We're the same. We've got the RPT, the PTR, we've got Modern Tennis. We've got a few organizations. But basically, the LTA do run courses and do have designations of coach. So in some senses, it's not too... You might argue whether or not the courses are good, but there is a structure. You have a level 1, a level 2, a level 3, a level 4, and a level 5 coaching qualification, which the LTA will be in charge of. And sometimes they have other people delivering it, but basically, so you do have a structure. Now, whether or not the public are aware enough of it, but so yes, and of course you need to get insurance, and so and the LTA do something called I'm licensed, which means I have to keep my qualification up to date. So every year I have to do a certain number of courses. I have to make sure I've got every 3 years I do a first aid course. I have to have a check, a child protection check, and so all of those things to be licensed. and then I get insurance and stuff like that. So that's pretty good, really.
Insurance for liability in case someone gets hurt you're teaching, or insurance for what?
Insurance for liability against kids getting hurt or anyone. And also I can get employed because I have coaches working at the club because I'm in charge of other coaches. So I get something called employer's liability, which I pay for separately. But I try all the coaches who teach individually, I will make sure that they have insurance themselves.
Who owns the clubs? Are they public or are they owned by the members? Or
all kinds of different things. And my club is, most of the clubs I've been at, in fact, all the clubs I've been at have been members' clubs, owned by the members. And the club I'm at the moment is the 12th oldest club in the world. It's Leicestershire Lawn Tennis Club, which was made in 1878, which was 1 year after the first Wimbledon. And we're still going. And we now have 18.
How many grass?
Ah, that's such a good question. We used to have about 12, and now we've got zero grass. We've got too many synthetic, some people wouldn't say. We've got about 8 synthetic grass. We've got 4 artificial clay, which are superb. And we've got 4 hard, we must have 10. 10 artificial grass, which is too quick. 4 artificial clay and 4 tarmac. We're very lucky.
We got to change the name of your club, though. No more grass courts. You can't be the lawn tennis club anymore, can you?
Is paddle tennis tennis? No. Is real tennis tennis? No, it's real tennis. Lawn tennis, you could argue, is the game of tennis. So lawn tennis is the game we play. So it's like we're still called the Lawn Tennis Association. So you could argue that you guys calling yourselves the United States Tennis Association are wrong, because there's lots of different kinds of tennis. You could be paddle tennis, you could be playing there. So we would say that lawn tennis is the name of the game we play, because originally it was played on lawn.
Yep.
What do you think?
All right. I think that's probably accurate. We've got a couple of courts here of real tennis with that crooked heavy racket and those heavy balls. You know, I've seen that played a couple times. There's a club right here in Northern Virginia near us that has it. I think you're onto something there. We changed all our names here. We used to be the USLTA. Changed that. We used to be the USPTA, the United States USLPTA or something, the U.S. Lawn Professional Tennis. We changed that. So, you know, we've changed a lot of it over here, but we don't have we have still a few clubs in the Northeast that have some grass. There's actually an event this weekend called Church Cup, which is the oldest intersectional of the USTA sections. It's the oldest intersectional event in the U.S., and it's on grass. It's between the Eastern section, which is basically New York, New England section, which is basically Massachusetts, and North Connecticut, too. It's the Mid-Atlantic section, that's me, D.C., Virginia, and the Middle States section, which is basically New Jersey and Pennsylvania. But these fellows will get together and play on the grass this weekend. It happens once a year. So, you know, the grass is hanging in there, but here it's only at the elite clubs. It's, of course, very expensive to maintain. The equipment, the maintenance, the mowing of it. You know, the clay, you know, is a little less expensive to maintain. A lot of the areas that have public clay, you know, there are brushes on the courts, and people are expected to brush their own court at the end of play. We haven't gotten into too many of the artificial surfaces here.
Well, we still play. Did you ever play? We still do the veterans, and we can play at Wimbledon on the. We can play on the grass in the National Veterans, so that's blooming good. And we can still play grass. Candy Cup is all grass, where the candies play each other. We still get. When was the last time you played on grass, Bruce?
This would be a year ago, this time of the year, for this one event. Once a year. That's it.
Excellent. And it's great. You can throw yourself about, serve and volley.
Well, it's real grass, though. And when I say it's real grass, it's the kind of grass where when you step up to serve, you can't really bounce the ball too well before you serve if it's been raining some, because the ball doesn't bounce back to you. As opposed to, you know, Wimbledon nowadays looks like a really fast hard court.
Wimbledon is still soft. We play on the, that's why everyone used to serve and volley, because the courts were so bad that if you made the ball bounce twice, you'd win the point, wouldn't you? And it's like you'd be the first one to hit a volley. People don't really appreciate just how bad the grass courts used to be in the tournament. But especially by the end of the summer. But it was a lot of fun, I guess.
Well, it's interesting because I've often talked about the evolution of tennis and how the evolution of the style of play today is based on the courts that the people are learning to play on, whereas, you know, 40 years ago, the season was, you know, there was a full one-third of the season was on grass, one-third of the season might have been on clay in Europe, and one-third of the season might have been indoor on cement. So being able to volley was really important.
Yeah.
You know, whereas nowadays, being able to volley isn't as important, but I think it's short-sighted, you know, of players not to learn to play in transition and to play the whole court. Unless you can counterpunch like Nadal and Djokovic and run like these guys, you better learn to do something else.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all good.
Let me ask you the last couple questions here. In the junior development, in that phrase that we use here, junior development, you know, a lot of our kids are under the impression that if they don't go to an academy, you know, they can't succeed. So first question, do you guys have these academies all over, or is it still the neighborhood club and your kids just come to the club and hang out there all day and play with anyone who shows up? How do your kids do it?
The LTA have academies, and they push people into them now, which may be some clubs. So the LTA have academies.
And the academies are at the clubs?
No, they designate, well, they designate big indoor. You've got to be indoors, and they've got different grades of academy. So it's difficult to argue whether that's successful or not.
All right. And the how many tournaments a year will your kids play? A junior, a 14 and under, competitive junior player, wants to be good. How many tournaments a year will they play?
That's a good question. Well, mine now aren't playing enough, but when I was in London, probably a good player was playing a lot of tournaments. A lot. We've got a reasonable tournament system. But again, it's too big a subject to go into. The tournaments have changed in a sense. When I used to play, you go, you have a week-long tournament. Now they tend to be match plays where you go and you play two matches, or so you don't get the tournament feel, you don't get quite the social feel. But they're playing quite a lot of matches, quite a lot of tournaments. We don't have as big distances to cover as you guys, maybe.
Right, right.
But what's been lost a little bit is the social side of the tournament. So we used to go, we'd go on the Monday, you'd play 7 weeks of tournaments, go on the Monday, be in there on the Saturday if you're lucky, and you'd have six great weeks. Now it's there's not quite as there's a lot more weekend and match plays.
But, and in the wintertime?
Indoor match plays. But again, it's more for the better, Perez. Yeah, and every school holiday you'll have a tournament in your county that you can go to. So the tournament structure isn't too bad, I would say. I would say it's reasonably good, the tournament structure.
You know, do you think it's possible for the LTA, for the UK, to find a place again amongst the leading countries of the world in tennis, or is that day long gone?
I think any country can. Look at Sweden. When they got Borg, and they then went to the top. Any country can. America certainly can. Goodness, any country can. And so, yes, of course. We have wonderful clubs, a wonderful tradition, lots of people wanting to play, strong coaches. There's no reason we shouldn't be. The question would be why we're not.
That's the question. Well, I was working my way around to it, and since you asked it, just give me a couple of bullet points on not just why you're not. Don't give me problems. Give me solutions.
Solutions. I think we get huge amounts of money from Wimbledon, which goes to the LTA. The LTA partly owns it. I think the LTA would be well served to put that money out to coaches. What you said was very good. You know, actually trusting coaches, taking away the central. I mean, I think the LTA are good at very many things, but probably not at producing players. But so if they give money to private or coaches, push it out away into the clubs, into the coaches, rather than centralizing it. So they've centralized stuff, push it out, you know, and take the pressure off themselves. But
I think it's homegrown. I think champions are homegrown.
We're good at all sports in Britain. Well, you know, we've done very well at sport. We're a sporting country, and I'm sure we will do well. And I'm sure you guys will. We just got to keep on trying, haven't we? And doing our best. And
that's all we can do. We just keep on battling. And have you ever entertained the thought of maybe relocating with your passion and your skill set to a place where courts are more accessible and weather might be a little better, or is yours to staying where you are?
Definitely staying where I am. But I love track. I've been playing a lot in Europe on the clay this year. I'm playing a few tournaments and just loving it. I'm English and I'll stay in England. But play in Europe a bit at the moment. Yeah.
Well, it's nothing like the red clay. The red clay. One day we were over in Barcelona. It was like mud. It was raining. It was cold. And
yes.
2 days later, it was hot and it was dry. And you know, just from day to day, it's so nice and so different.
I played in Spain just quickly in the European Club Championships. It hadn't rained for 8 months. I mean, that was a high ball. You know, that ball was
getting high.
But,
that's a high ball. That thing will bounce up. What city were you guys in?
That was La Manga. It was just during European Club Championships. But yeah, it actually rained so much that people died from floods while we were there. But it hadn't rained for 8 months. So pretty good.
Mm. Well, it sounds like you guys are dealing with some of similar challenges to ours over there, but some very different. You know, I think as a tennis community, we all got to stick together and keep on pushing forward just for the benefit of our sport. And, if anybody does well, everybody does well, and it just makes our sport that much better.
Very true.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. Unfortunately, here we won't see every ball at Wimbledon, but we'll have, one channel to cover it, and they'll go from court to court. And, then when the U.S. Open comes on, we don't even get every ball hit there. We have the same coverage of the U.S. Open as Wimbledon as the French Open. But our country definitely starts hopping a little bit around the U.S. Open time. But, certainly maybe you guys, this will be the year where you springboard through Wimbledon and more kids show up at your club to play, and this is where it all begins. The ignition starts today, we hope.
Well, maybe, Bruce. That's very positive. We just keep on trucking, really. But yes, I don't know. We've been relying on someone big coming through. We've got Andy Murray, but I think we do need to change. Maybe the change will come. But I don't know. We've been doing this a long time, haven't we?
We have. Well, before we call it a day, last thing I just want you to tell us about your book a little bit that you wrote about the man who moved Wimbledon, George Hilliard.
Matt. Okay. Well, yes. Well, my club is, as I said, was about 100 and something million years old. And a guy called George Hilliard, I noticed, lived nearby and used to be a member. And in 1896, which is quite a long time ago, he moved to near my club. And he obviously had a bit of money. He was married to a lady called Blanche, who had won Wimbledon six times. And they had a tennis court, a perfect grass court. They had a hard court, had a golf course on their grounds, and they invited everyone from around the world would come to their home. So Norman Brooks, who was the first Australian winner from abroad, everyone at that time would come and play on their court. And he was an incredible guy, and it was like the center of the universe for tennis. And in the end, he went to Wimbledon, and he became secretary of Wimbledon, and he was there for a long time. He got the queen, the prince who became the king, so he got the royalty into Wimbledon. And he was just a very amazing guy. And Wimbledon used to be at a different place, and most people don't know, but it wasn't actually at the grounds it's at now. For the first 46 years, it was a different place, and it moved from that place to Church Road, where it is now, in 1922, and he was in charge of the move. And I just found all these great pictures. I found some relatives, so pictures that no one's ever seen from the first Wimbledon at Church Road and people queuing. I found his original album with pictures from tournaments all across Britain and in France. They used to go off to France and play there. And it's just incredible that tennis was a mature game in 1922. So before Wimbledon started, it had been going for 46 years, which is as long after that was like Passarell and Santana, Passarell and Gonzalez. I mean, it's 46 years is a long time, and people forget it. People forget. And I think, like golfers, if you ask a golfer, they want to know what ball, what used to be in 100 years ago, what clubs they were using. I think tennis players sometimes, we're not that interested in the history of our game. And in a sense, it's quite interesting. I find it, because I'm a bit of a geek, I find it interesting. And so, yes, I wrote a book about this, and it's getting... And Mark Cox, who was... if you've heard... Have you heard of Mark Cox?
Yes, of course.
He was a British tennis player who played, actually, in the last time we were in the Davis Cup final, he played in the doubles against Smith and Lutz. And you had McEnroe and Connors, and you killed us. And Mark is used to be a member at Leicestershire, and he's a friend, and he wrote the foreword to the book. And it's just released about a week ago, and it's going all right. It's being stocked at the Tennis Gallery in Wimbledon, and people are enjoying it. But just that whole thing of tennis history, I think, is a little bit neglected by us guys who play tennis.
Well, I love history. I've got, I'm looking on my desk right now, I've got The Art of Lawn Tennis, Tennis Origins, Tennis, The Meaning of Life, Tennis, A Cultural History. Yeah. Tennis as a Sublimation for Sex. That's an interesting book. But got all kinds of books on history and tennis. I love it. I'm going to have to pick up a copy of your book, and I look forward to reading it. I'd love to learn about it.
I'm pleased. I'll put you down for one, Bruce.
All right. Well, Bruce, I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us today. It's always good to make a new tennis friend. It's always good to learn a little bit about what's going on somewhere else in our great sport. And you know, we're going to have to find a way somehow, you know, with all those grass courts you got, it's my best surface. I might have to come visit now.
Well, I do. It's really, 'cause I looked at it. I mean, you're a tennis player, Bruce, aren't you? You were an American national champion?
I won a couple of doubles events, and I don't know about national. I won a couple national tournaments here and there and a little age group stuff sometimes, but just got back from Barcelona. We had an IC event. You guys had a team over there who was competing well. Some years ago, you guys really used to have a good team. Bates was over there, and Fullwood, and Graham.
Do you admit to what your age group is? I'll tell you if you'll tell me.
I'm moving on to the 50s next year. My last year in the 45s.
45s. Gosh, yes. Well, we won the 55s, the British team, which I wasn't in. We won the 55s. I just think it's great. Veterans tennis or seniors tennis is just a great thing. It's like being a kid again. And, congratulations to be in the American team. That's superb.
It's good fun. You know, you get together with the guys, and it is like being a kid again. It's just being on a team, traveling together with some guys, playing some matches, having a beer after. It's wonderful stuff.
Yes. Yes.
There's a group going over this year to play. I played against Great Britain in Avery Cup 2 years ago. We hosted it here. This year it's at Wimbledon in July. But I didn't get an invite from our squad to go. And last year, though, I played against Oxford and Cambridge. You know, they were short guys, so they had to bring the old guy in. And I'll have you know, I did win all my matches in these events, but I relied on a much younger, stealthier doubles partner to carry me.
That's great. Yeah. Well, gosh, congratulations. And the 50s next year, you're going to kill them.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I just thought that, you know, at this age, Bruce, we just hope to not get injured.
Exactly. I never win a match when the guy doesn't tell me about his injuries.
Every time I win, the guy got hurt, and every time I lose, I got hurt.
Absolutely. Oh, get the eyesight. Yes. Well, the great thing about tennis is that tennis people, tennis clubs, they're the same everywhere. And every country, we're all the same. And that's the great thing about tennis and tennis clubs.
Well, I certainly think that that's the bond, whether we speak a common language or not, that all over the world keeps us together. So, you know, we'll keep doing our thing. We'll keep spreading the gospel of tennis as we do. And, you know, I enjoyed this. Now that I know how the Skype thing works, and you got the Skype and I got the Skype, we'll have to chat again soon.
I'd love it. I'd like it very much, Bruce.
All right, Bruce, have a great day. Thanks for spending time with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Good luck in America.
Okay. Thanks. Speak to you soon. Okay, bye. All right, folks, that's our show today. You know, I got caught up in just having a wonderful conversation, didn't get to a couple of emails that some folks sent in, so I'll try to get answers to those, and we'll have them on the show next week. Hope you enjoyed learning a little about tennis in another culture, and, you know, Bruce's book, if you're a tennis person, a historian, George Hilliard, The Man Who Moved Wimbledon, if you just look it up on Amazon, it's incredibly interesting. What this guy did, when this guy did it, and how it was done, and how tennis was a tremendously romantic game at one point in time. Folks, hope you get out there and hit some balls. I'm glad we made it through the show today without the thunderstorms taking our electricity. Hope everyone's having a wonderful day. Look forward to spending some time with you next week. Make it a good week.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.